4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, the program where we ask the question, what does it mean to be living in the new geologic age? I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today we'll be featuring an interview with paleobiologist and geologist John Payne. Stay tuned.
I'm sitting here with Dr. Jonathan Payne, Assistant Professor of Geological Environmental Sciences at Stanford University. He's a paleobiologist and studies the relationship between environmental change and biological evolution in the fossil record. His primary research focus is understanding the causes behind mass extinction events, as well as the processes that control the recovery of species and ecosystems. Could you describe the Permian-Triassic extinction event? What did the world look like back then? What were the dominant species? Just paint the picture.
The end Permian extinction event we know about largely from compilations of species diversity in rocks of different ages. When one goes out and looks at Permian rocks, there's a much greater diversity of fossils than there are in the earliest Triassic rocks. In terms of what the world looked like back then, there are a number of things that are familiar to us today that would not have been in the world then, and maybe that's the easiest place to start. For example, flowering plants or angiosperms, the plants that are crops today for us, corn, rice, wheat, none of those plants existed at this time. None of the fruit trees that you see around you existed, and none of the pretty flowers in flower beds around you existed. And so if you were outside looking at plants on the ground, you would see a number of groups of plants that are less familiar to us today. You would see a number of extinct groups of plants. In particular, in the southern latitudes, there was a group of large trees known as glossopterids that had very long sort of meter-scale leaves. This group of plants went entirely extinct. You would have seen ancient relatives of conifers, of pine trees. In terms of the terrestrial vertebrate community, this was prior to the evolution of mammals, also prior to the evolution of dinosaurs, though you would have seen earlier relatives of those groups. In the oceans, modern reef-forming corals, the scleractinian corals, had yet to evolve at least as a group of calcifying organisms. There were probably soft-bodied relatives of these animals in the oceans at that time. But there were several other groups of corals that existed at that time, a group known as the rugose corals and another group known as the tabulate corals. Both of those groups of corals went entirely extinct at the end of the Permian. The last trilobites, one of the better known or maybe probably more familiar to many of the listeners, groups of Paleozoic fossils, so fossils that characterize the time from the Cambrian or the initial radiation of animals to the end of the Permian, they weren't terribly diverse or abundant by the end of the Permian, but they did experience their final complete extinction at the end of the Permian.
So you've talked a lot about extinctions in general. What constitutes a mass extinction? Is there any way you quantify it?
Right. That's a great question and something that paleontologists have been arguing about for quite a while. In general, the way people begin to approach this question is to ask, is the magnitude of a mass extinction different from extinction during other times? And it's probably useful here to stop and realize that understanding global diversity is a hard problem. First, we need to figure out how rocks of different ages are related to one another in distant parts of the world. If we want to know global diversity at some time in the Permian, we need to know which rocks are Permian in North America and which rocks are the same age in Australia, China, Russia, etc. What that means is at the global scale, we actually really only have about 5 to 10 million year resolution for much of the fossil record. And so what we do is we count up the number of species or in most cases actually higher taxa, genera, or families, and attempt to understand how many of those were in existence during any given interval of geological time. And so mass extinctions are really recognized on two criteria. One, did the diversity change from one time interval to another? And then second, was that diversity change driven largely by an elevated rate of extinction or a reduced rate of origination, a reduced rate of new taxa coming into the geological record. Mass extinction events simply are the stages or the time intervals where we see the highest rates of extinction. There's a lot of discussion about whether these are statistical outliers relative to other geological stages, and if so, whether they might constitute a separate kind of event from what we might call background extinction.
So what do you think caused the end Permian mass extinction?
So identifying mass extinctions as something that happened is done largely by counting up taxa, by compiling biodiversity. Understanding what caused it tends to require other modes of inquiry. There are a few different ways that people have gone after these questions. One is to look at patterns of extinction selectivity, to say not just how many taxa went extinct, but was there a special pattern of the extinction that might point toward the cause? Were particular kinds of organisms eliminated that might be particularly sensitive to particular kinds of extinction causes? The second way that people look at this is to look at geological evidence, to ask what do we see in the geological record that can tell us about the environmental circumstances of extinction. You may know, for example, that at the end of the Cretaceous, there was another mass extinction event. This is the one that eliminated the last of the dinosaurs. In association with that extinction event, we find geochemical evidence indicating that an extraterrestrial body impacted the Earth and left a global fallout layer. And now we also know where the impact crater is from that asteroid impact. In the case of the end of the Permian, it's a little bit less clear. The major geological event that's associated with the end Permian extinction is a major volcanic eruption in Siberia known as the Siberian Traps. This set of volcanic eruptions let out enough lava to cover the lower 48 United States, somewhere on the order of, you know, an eighth to a quarter mile deep in lava. So this is an enormous amount of lava. So we know that that was happening at the same time. There are indications in the geological record that these flood basalt eruptions had an impact on global environments and not just on the areas that they were burying in lava. Most of those indications come from geochemical studies, particularly looking at isotopes of different elements in marine rocks. So in this case, people are looking at ratios, for example, of carbon-13 to carbon-12, which can tell us about how the global carbon cycle is working, or ratios of nitrogen-15 to nitrogen-14, which can tell us about how the nitrogen cycle is working. The real challenge, then, is to understand these direct measurements of isotopes and how they may relate to volcanic eruptions, for example.
Right. So the Earth in general is 4.6 billion years old, and you study mass extinctions that occurred well over 200 million years ago. How might you communicate the sense of geologic time?
At a certain point, it does become secondhand, but it becomes secondhand, I think, in a particular way, which is that I think you end up changing your frame of reference. Mm-hmm. And so it's very difficult to think about these timescales relative to human timescales. But hundreds of thousands of years relative to millions of years is something that I can get my hands around. Hundreds of thousands or millions of years relative to a day, I find very difficult to accurately gauge. Often when people teach about these kinds of things, we rescale geological time to a day or a year. Mm-hmm. What you find, right, is that if you scale geological time to a day, for example, anatomically modern humans show up, I think, in the last minute or maybe even the last second before the end of the day. And so it gives you a sense that we've been around for a vanishingly small amount of geological time.
As a geologist, how do we define geologic boundaries? What do they mean?
So geological boundaries are defined based on fossils. If we go back in time to when most of the geological timescale was being developed, this was primarily during the 19th century, when the basic framework of the modern geological timescale was laid out. And at that point, of course, we had no ability to radiometrically date rocks. And so absolute time was something very difficult to come to grips with or very difficult to constrain. But people recognized very early on that by identifying fossils in particular layers of sedimentary rock, that those sequences of fossils were characteristic of the entire planet. And so that you could define geological time in the rocks you were looking at based on the fossils that were in them. The major era boundaries were defined based on the largest changes in fossil composition. And so it's not surprising then to figure out that those are the intervals of the end Permian and end Cretaceous mass extinctions, times when many, many groups of animals went extinct. And that explains why the fossils changed so much. Similarly, when we look at other mass extinctions, these occurred at the end of the Ordovician period, very late in the Devonian period, at the end of the Triassic period, end of the Permian period, end of the Cretaceous period. The period boundaries are there because of the biological changes. And mm-hmm. so it's not that mass extinctions happen to occur at the end of periods. It's that we define periods and other geological intervals based on changes in fossils.
Is it all based on fossil record, or is there also a climatic component?
The climate component is really indirect. So the climate component is there because many of these changes in fossils are associated with environmental change, and including, in many cases, climate. But the time intervals were not defined based on climate, largely because the time intervals were defined before we had good proxies for climate. The other key thing to recognize is that the geological periods and epochs and stages were defined by mapping geologists. So these are people who are outside looking at the relationships between layers of rocks. And so they needed to be able to define rock ages based on things that they could see in the field. Climate is largely determined through geochemical measurements that are done in the laboratory, whereas the major geological divisions of time are defined based on fossils that we can see in the field. And this was, you know, more practical than anything. It was because people were trying to go out and map the rocks. And so having to collect rocks, bring them back to the lab and measure them isn't nearly as straightforward a way to do this as to have criteria that you can actually use while you're in the field.
So one of the points you made earlier was that our resolution decreases the further you go back in time. If you look at dating the Cretaceous tertiary extinction, what killed the dinosaurs? You know, it's 65 million years ago, plus or minus 300,000 years. Where would you put the actual extinction event? Is it the meteor that hit or the asteroid that hit? Is it after a certain amount of percentage of species die off?
That's a great question. In practical terms, it turns out in most cases not to matter too much. Because rocks are in almost all cases deposited relatively slowly relative to the kinds of processes that you were talking about, they all collapse to the same point in the rocks. And so whether you're interested in the exact moment that the asteroid pierced the atmosphere, struck the Earth, or the time period of hours to days or weeks, months, years, decades later when all of the extinctions happened, all of that is the same point in the geological record from a physical standpoint of looking at a stack of rocks and saying, okay, which layer represents where the extinction event happened. And so essentially that lack of time resolution means that for practical purposes, we don't really actually have to answer that question very precisely. This gets harder as you come close to the present, right, where people are interested in the concept of the Anthropocene and when did that start.
Where would you put the start of the Anthropocene?
Right. So I was thinking about this before I came into the interview today. And I guess, you know, right now we'll argue about that question. What I would say is any geologist that comes back millions of years later, it won't matter to them mm-hmm. because they won't be able to tell the difference anymore. If you wanted to define it when anatomically modern humans show up in the rock record, so say a quarter million years ago, maybe that would be distinguishable in sort of the types of sedimentary sections that we typically see preserved in the rock record. If we're arguing about whether it's the Industrial Revolution versus, say, World War II or the Green Revolution, those differences are going to be very, very difficult for anyone to distinguish except right now. As we were talking about for the end Cretaceous as well, it's part of a continuum, right? There's an interval of very rapid change relative to what happens most of the time. Exactly where in that interval of rapid change you put the boundary is clearly open for debate. I don't have a strong opinion on that one way or another.
It just really won't matter down the line.
Down the line, it won't matter. Right now, it's interesting to argue over, but in many ways, I think you end up getting into a semantic argument. What I think is unambiguous is that humans are having an impact on the planet, the likes of which has never been seen before, with the possible exception of cyanobacteria inventing oxygenic photosynthesis 2.5 billion years ago. We are, as a single species, altering the Earth's biogeochemical cycles in enormous ways, either directly or indirectly causing extinction of some species and taking in some ways direct or indirect control of aspects of climate. All of that is true regardless of where we decide to place an Anthropocene boundary. You know, you can imagine if we change the scale of the discussion, right? So let's say we agree that World War II is the time. Then I say, okay, well, which year of World War II, right? Which day, which hour, which minute? And then you can start to see that that question becomes a little bit silly. From a geological perspective, this is a very, very rapid event. And placing the boundary anywhere between the origin of modern humans and right now seems perfectly reasonable to me.
So one of our impacts is on the biodiversity of life on Earth. We are causing extinctions. Do these extinction rates and loss of biodiversity, are they at all comparable with previous mass extinction rates? Are we heading towards another mass extinction?
That's a great question and a difficult one, because it all depends on how the rates continue for much longer intervals of time. The quick answer is, if you extrapolate the rates of extinction that we're seeing today for tens to hundreds of thousands of years, then absolutely we'll end up in a mass extinction. Right now, the amount of extinction that has occurred is very small relative to the amount of extinction that ultimately characterizes the major extinction events that we're seeing in the geological record. For example, since the Pleistocene, we've lost on the order of 10 to 15% of terrestrial mammals in North America. Of species. At the end of the Permian, in the oceans where we have a much better record, we know that we lost upwards of 90% of the species in the ocean. And so we have a very long way to go to get to the end Permian based on where we are right now. And having seen early Triassic rocks right after the end Permian extinction, I sincerely hope that we never get there. The big question is how these rates will continue over the next decades to centuries. Clearly, in many cases, we're eliminating species that had small geographic ranges, small population sizes, and so we're probably at the highest risk of extinction due to other causes before human interference. The big question then is, of the species that are around right now, what fraction of them are going to be sensitive to extinction? And as we start losing those that are most endangered already, will more and more species become critically endangered? Or will the ones that are not endangered now never become endangered because they're in one way or another capable of inhabiting the altered planet that we're giving them? And there, I don't know what the answer is to that.
What are some of the consequences that would arise from like a loss of biodiversity?
In some ways, it depends on exactly what taxa are lost. Certainly, every species represents a unique evolutionary history, and so has some unique genetic information in it, may produce unique compounds, some of which may be useful to humans. Many aspects of the biology and ecology of these species are undoubtedly useful to other species that they interact with in one way or another. The challenging part is understanding that these ecosystems are very complicated sets of interactions. And so as we pull species out of those sets of interactions, we may see very little change, or we may see very large changes. Some of that may be obvious ahead of time, and some may not. One of the things that we do see after mass extinctions is major alteration of ecosystems, and alteration that lasts on timescales of hundreds of thousands to millions of years. And so if there's anything I think that paleontology has to offer that's useful in terms of what's happening to the planet today, beyond potentially helping to assess which species are likely to be at long-term risk of extinction, it's that recovery timescales are glacial compared to policy-relevant timescales. Although the Earth will undoubtedly recover from whatever humans do to it, it won't recover on a timescale that's relevant to us or our children or our grandchildren or their great-grandchildren. One way of thinking about it is anything we decide to do to the planet is permanent for all practical purposes, whether it's putting CO2 into the atmosphere or eliminating species or changing ecosystems.
So just to clarify, when we talk about biodiversity loss, the culprit isn't just global warming. There are other direct human impacts that we have, like deforestation, creating dams, etc., right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head. I wouldn't be surprised if more of the extinctions that have happened so far are actually due to direct human intervention in ecosystems rather than to indirect effects like global warming.
I know a lot of climatologists emphasize that there's a bell curve of possible outcomes. Stephen Schneider would say that the doom and gloom scenario is just as unlikely as the everything's going to be perfectly fine outcome. What kind of outcome do you see us progressing towards?
That's a tough question for me because it's really outside of my area of expertise. As a citizen with a paleontological background looking at what's happening, certainly, as we've talked about, you know, just the fact that we're discussing a change in the name of the geological interval that we're living in from the Holocene to the Anthropocene suggests that the magnitude of Earth system change that we're imposing is very large. Then I think best case versus doom and gloom start to become value judgments of what do we want our society to look like. From my perspective, what's very clear is the magnitude of change that we're imposing on the Earth system is going to be very large, even at the very low end of that bell curve. Whether those changes end up being good or bad for us or for other species on the planet depends on what sort of value judgments we make about how ecosystems function. I think one sensible way to think about it may be in terms of human health, for example. Obviously, some of the changes that are happening have been very good for human health and human society. Other changes, not so good. On the other hand, we certainly wouldn't be here if it weren't for these events. These events change ecosystems in ways that ultimately led to the evolution of human beings. And so So we can't be entirely sorry about them either, I don't think. When you have that viewpoint of looking at these events long afterward and seeing what happens in the aftermath, it tends to lead to interesting new evolutionary pathways in many cases. For evolution to work, you need enormous amounts of time. How many generations do you need to go from a mouse-sized mammal to an elephant-sized mammal, for example? Even with very fast rates of evolution, you clearly need thousands of years. In reality, you need millions or many millions. I certainly agree that there's understanding the human impact on climate is important and very hard for people to grasp. And I think that the key thing there is the timescales, right? That rates that are very fast on geological timescales are not noticeable on human timescales. Most of us, even myself, right? I mean, I don't know about global climate change because of what I see every day when I go outside. I know about it because of the data that we're collecting about the planet as a whole. That suggests to me, right, that the education about geological time is critical for anyone to understand this, because it's not a visceral thing that we experience every day.
Dr. John Payne, thanks so much for sitting down with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project. And you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/Anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?